I am not here to tell you that Congress has reached a deal to help out the American economy. I am here to tell you that that economy is hurting, and the pain is not evenly distributed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, August 4th. Thanks for joining us today. And yes, as of this recording, Congress has not reached a deal on pandemic relief for this economy. Democrats are insisting on extended unemployment benefits and eviction moratoriums. Republicans disagree. Republicans also don't even agree on their own bill. Hopes are not high for an agreement. And the economic carnage goes on. For the last several months, we've been watching the pandemic hit Black-owned businesses particularly hard, and a new report from the New York Federal Reserve confirms that and looks into the reasons why. As Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, a lot of it comes down to relationships with banks.
Getting that first round of PPP funding was like running a race, and Vera Daniels was miles away from the starting line when the gun went off.
I sent emails out to a listing of about 100 banks. It just felt helpless.
Daniels owns Wellness Tea Therapy, a tea house and wellness center in Brooklyn, New York. She banks with a credit union, and it couldn't help her apply for a loan, so she had to find a bank that would. But
the banks suggested that the primary concern would be their customers.
Daniels still hasn't found funding. She's pivoted to online sales and says she's hanging in there. But a lot of other Black entrepreneurs can't say the same. The number of Black business owners in the U.S. fell more than 40% between February and April. That's more than double the decline of white business owners. Claire Kramer Mills co-authored the study from the New York Federal Reserve.
We saw that there were real differences going into the crisis between Black and white-owned businesses.
She says a lot of this had to do with access to capital. Traditionally, Black businesses have had to look to friends or family, to 401ks, to short-term and often predatory lenders, and not to banks. Meanwhile, Black-owned businesses are concentrated in places the virus has hit hardest.
These places have had a double whammy.
It's just like, you know, really worsening an already bad situation in the Black community.
Belinda Archibong teaches economics at Barnard College. She says Black health and Black wealth are intertwined. And the only way to change the outlook for Black-owned businesses where COVID has hit hard is to directly allocate funds to them.
And that's something that needs to happen with federal regulation.
Perhaps a targeted federal loan program, especially now that it's clear this COVID crisis is a marathon, not a sprint. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Congress does have some consensus around extending the Paycheck Protection Program, but more than 100 current and former corporate CEOs have sent a letter to Congress pushing for a relief package that goes beyond that and specifically props up small businesses. But a lot of the names on the list are actually CEOs of major U.S. corporations like Starbucks, Walmart, Dunkin', and Ulta. So why do such large corporations care about small businesses? Marketplace's Mariel Seguera reports.
Remember in like sixth grade science class when you learned how every part of the environment is connected? Say an invasive species of fleas ends up in a lake, and those fleas eat all the plankton. Then the fish starve, because they usually eat the plankton. And on and on. Neil Bradley at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says the economy is kind of like that.
We think of it as an ecosystem.
To survive, big retailers need small businesses. They make a lot of the products that we all buy. Think about when you walk into a big box store.
You go back to the sporting goods department and maybe you're buying fishing lures to go out and go fishing. You'll find that many of those things are made by small businesses. You go into the crafts department, you'll find the same thing.
So if those businesses are closing, retailers might have trouble stocking shelves. Also, small businesses are a large part of the economy. They produce about 44% of U.S. GDP. Karen Kerrigan is with the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council.
And they employ 58.9 million Americans. So, you know, these are people that shop at a lot of these big businesses, these big retailers.
And if they don't have jobs, they may be less willing to spend money at Walmart or Ulta. The CEO letter asks Congress to create a new loan program for small companies that lasts more than a few months, includes at least partial loan forgiveness, and targets loans to businesses owned by people of color who've traditionally had less access to them. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, investors briefly seemed vaguely alarmed that an ongoing lack of federal pandemic relief could prove economically problematic, and then they got over it. Or it could have been indigestion. Really hard to know these days. Details when we do the numbers. Let's check in on the virus itself. There is an unprecedented global effort happening to find a vaccine. Companies and research labs are building upon work that goes back years and years, of course, but they're also using innovations in vaccine development that have only been around the last 10 years or so.
This, the vaccine itself, the end product of medicine's long match with measles.
For hundreds of years, a vaccine was like, well, let's take a dead piece of the bug and put it inside the body, and the body's immune system will figure out what to do.
Safi Bakal is a biotech investor and author of the book Loon Shots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. The technique he's talking about, well, that's how the first measles vaccines were created in the 60s.
The body's immune system is sort of like sniffer dogs, and you give a little taste of the virus, a little piece of the sweater or an old shoe, like a little fragment of the protein of the virus. And then those antibodies go hunting around your blood and they start policing the blood for anything that smells like it and then attack it as soon as it comes into your blood.
Then about 40 years ago, scientists figured out how to genetically engineer those virus proteins in a lab. That meant better quality control and a faster, safer, cheaper process. Today, scientists are using both of those methods to try to create a COVID-19 vaccine, along with another, much newer approach.
Suppose instead of manufacturing all these viruses or protein fragments or dead viruses and using that as a vaccine, suppose we skip that step and just take the code, the instructions for making that fragment, and give it to the body's cells. So instead of having a giant lab and a warehouse cranking out these proteins that we then put into lots of vials and deliver billions of doses around the world, your own cells will be the manufacturing plant.
While this technique has been around for 10 years, it hasn't yet led to a successful vaccine for any disease, mainly because there's a huge shortage of funding for vaccine research of all kinds.
The problem is there hasn't been enough incentive to work in infectious disease. Mm-hmm. SARS-CoV-1, which came out 18 years ago, the first sort of version of the SARS virus, is 80% genetically identical to the current SARS-CoV virus. We had started some promising work and promising drugs and promising vaccines against that first SARS virus, some of which may have been enormously helpful.
These days, of course, there's plenty of incentive to both cure and treat COVID-19. Bakal says, in fact, even by the time we get a vaccine, we might have much better success at preventing deaths from the virus. He likened it to HIV, where there's no vaccine, but drug development has turned that virus from a fatal condition to a chronic one.
Every month we get more data on what drug works. And it's not just the exciting stuff of, hey, a scientist in the lab came up with this awesome new molecule that nobody ever saw before, and it eradicates the virus on first contact. That's not how it works. Sometimes it's like a pretty boring old drug that none of us thought mattered very much actually works, or the right combination. By itself, it's okay, but if you combine A and B, it's really amazing. They don't make sexy headlines, but they're really important.
So despite all the very bad headlines, Bakal said he's feeling positive.
One of the reasons that I'm optimistic is just the number of shots on goal that we have. And for most diseases, you know, maybe you develop 5 drugs or 10 drugs in clinical trials. Today, we have over 300 treatments in development for COVID. Those of us working in the industry, we've never seen anything like this. No one around today has ever seen anything like the mobilization we have in the scientific and research community for 80 years.
Safi Bacall is a biotech investor and author of the book Loon Shots. This interview was featured in the hour-long Marketplace Tech special, The Pivot Point, which you can hear this week on public radio stations or online at marketplace.org. The recent Black Lives Matter protests across the U.S. and the world have led to a backlash against brands selling skin lightening creams in South Asia, including countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. Major brands like Johnson & Johnson have even taken their creams off the shelves. But it's unclear whether the campaign will really impact the business. The BBC's Nikhil Imandur has more from Mumbai.
Skin lightening creams are a big business in India. It's a nearly $1 billion market. That's partly because there's widespread discrimination against people with darker skin. In movies and fashion, lighter-skinned actors and models get the best roles. And the preference for whiter skin is a long-ingrained social aesthetic. Like Vaidehi, who teaches French in the southern Indian city of Bangalore. She has darker skin and remembers only negative reactions to it.
One very early memory is when a cousin of mine had just taken a bath. And then she said, "Oh, did you just take a bath? You still look dirty," somehow implying that to her, dark skin is dirty.
Such episodes of blatant prejudice were common for Vaidehi. She says she suffered because of it her entire life. The skin lightening industry has thrived by milking the insecurities of people like her. Advertising promotes the notion if you want to be considered beautiful and successful, whiter skin is the way to go.
For 2 months, I've been using Fair and Lovely.
But following the Black Lives Matter movement in the US, activists across South Asia have revived the call to ban skin lightening products. They are, critics say, the most visible symbols of colorism in the region. Marvi Ahmad is a US-based Pakistani activist who helped start an online petition back in June to ban Fair and Lovely, a cream marketed by Unilever. Thousands of people came forward to support her drive.
Because of the sheer number of people who took ownership of it and who took it personally, it turned into a kind of grassroots movement in which people of all countries of races were involved. And this conversation has come to a head because this is not the first time skin whitening industry or products such as Fair and Lovely have faced backlash, but they are being heard and the messages are spreading.
The pushback worked, partially. Unilever has decided to rename its brand Glow and Lovely, removing the word fair. And the company's much smaller competitor in this category, Johnson & Johnson, has stopped selling whitening products altogether. Walk into any pharmacy or general store and you'll find tens of other options for skin lightening creams by local and global brands. The allure is powerful and the messaging not so subtle in a country whose obsession with lighter skin runs deep. In fact, the industry is growing at 10 to 12% every year. That makes it harder for companies that make stuff like shampoos and face creams to give up on skin lightening products completely, says Ankur Bisson, vice president at Technopack, a consumer brand consultancy.
Until the entire industry or the sector comes together and say this category should be banned going forward, I don't think much will change on the ground as far as these steps are concerned.
But for there to be a real shift in mindsets, the fight will have to be against the deeply entrenched biases around race and colour that have propelled these products to success in the first place. In Mumbai, I'm the BBC's Nikhil Imandur for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the toy that my parents said no to.
I'm sure my kid can think of a few. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 164 points. There was some uncertainty early, though, 0.6% to close at 26,828. The NASDAQ was up 38 points, 0.3% to end at 10,941. And the S&P 500 rose 11 points, 0.3% to end at 3306. Eastman Kodak Company, Kodak, was down about 3% today on news that the Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating the trading in Kodak stock that happened when that company announced a $765 million government loan to produce drug ingredients. Kodak stock jumped 26% the day before the deal was announced. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.50%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. We talk a lot about the asymmetrical effects of this pandemic in society and in business, where some industries have been driven to their knees and others are doing better than they ever have, like video games. Video game sales have spiked, up almost 20% over a year ago, but there's inequality here too. Against the backdrop of record profits, the industry is facing a reckoning for how it treats workers. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
The business of making video games is often a passion project, says Dimitri Williams, a gaming expert at the University of Southern California.
Of course, it's our baby and we're willing to put in extra hours to do it.
But as scrappy startups have become multi-billion dollar enterprises, the norms of sometimes 100-hour work weeks with no extra pay have started rubbing workers the wrong way.
When you're essentially in service to the man, it's less exciting to be working on something at 2 a.m.
Recent years have brought increased scrutiny of toxic work culture, discrimination, and inadequate pay. This week, Bloomberg News reported employees at Blizzard Entertainment, which makes World of Warcraft, have been circulating a spreadsheet to anonymously share salaries. Renee Gittens, who heads the International Game Developers Association, says a recent survey found about a third of developers make less than $50,000 a year.
Considering that most game development studios and teams are in high cost of living areas, that can be quite a low salary.
The survey showed people of color and women remain underrepresented in gaming.
The industry has had problems when it comes to treating people equally and providing safe spaces for interactions.
In recent months, dozens of women in gaming have made public charges of discrimination and harassment on social media. Last December, Riot Games, the maker of League of Legends, agreed to a $10 million gender discrimination settlement.
That is not an encouraging sign if there's labor unrest.
Dieter Weitznager heads CTW Investment Group. He's called on the companies to address pay disparities and other workplace issues that can harm worker morale and ultimately their bottom lines. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The University of Texas at Austin reopens in just a few weeks, in person, yes. There will be limits on the number of students living in dorms and learning in classrooms, but lots of Austin's businesses depend on the spending power of students, and they are eager for even a partial return to normalcy. Marketplace's Andy Euler lives in Austin. He talked with students and business owners about what they're expecting.
When the coronavirus became a crisis back in March, UT sent everyone home. The school said classes in the fall will be limited to 40% capacity, and most students will have the option to take all their classes online. Emma Hansen is a senior studying chemical engineering.
I still feel like I am totally in the dark about what my semester is going to be like ultimately.
Hansa says she'll only go to class when she absolutely has to, which isn't what businesses on campus want to hear. This is Guadalupe Street, a main thoroughfare that everybody calls the drag. Jennifer Hillhouse owns a spot that's well known to students on campus, Jen's Copies and Binding.
It has been a very scary summer for everybody on the drag. First, it was when South by Southwest canceled, and it was like, deep breath, okay. And then when UT closed, it was just like, well, crap.
The bread and butter at Jen's is those big binders of class reading material. But students taking Intro to Philosophy online from Dallas or Houston aren't going to be walking through Jen's print shop doors.
How long can you, hang in there and find out if this is going to subside or if this is going to transition into something where we are, that's it for us.
Just a couple of doors from Jen's Copies, Muhammad Imran is wearing a black face mask as he upgrades a laptop. He owns Sam Computers, a repair shop, and he needs students to return.
We're not even able to make rent, and actually I'm paying from my pocket. I'm serious thinking about it, what's going to happen next.
Journalism senior Joe Levin knows what's next for him. This fall's semester, he's taking all of his classes online, which means his back-to-school shopping list ain't what it used to be.
I was talking with my roommate the other day, trying to figure out what all we needed. And I said, we need a printer. And he said, why? We aren't going to print anything.
As an online student, or one attending Zoom school, as he likes to call it, he'll just email his assignments. No need for hard copies. Ominous words for Jen's Copies on the drag. But owner Jennifer Hillhouse is hoping that students will need a print shop again someday.
Our hope is that our core business stays.
In the meantime, she's doing all she can to move more of her business online, in case this is the new normal. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
U.S. new vehicle sales were out yesterday, mostly meh, but a few makers like Hyundai and Mazda saw small gains, maybe a sign of recovery. But let's think back to happier times for a moment. For our new podcast, Million Bazillion, we asked Star Trek and Reading Rainbow's LeVar Burton about the first car he wanted, and he told us his parents' response.
The toy that my parents said no to, well, I will never forget that there was a slot car. Now, this is when I was like in the fourth grade. There was a slot car I wanted because there was a slot car shop in Sacramento where I grew up, where you could take your slot car and race it on a configured track against other people. It just occurred to me that maybe I need to explain what a slot car is. Little small scale model cars that ran on electricity. And the electricity was actually provided by the track itself. So you put your car on the track, and then you had a controller that gave you the ability to regulate the speed. And if too much speed, your car would fly off the track. The right amount of speed, your car would stay on the track. The perfect amount of speed, your car would stay on the track and remain fast going around the corner. So I wanted this slot car. I had a mini kind of version of that at home, but I wanted to play with the bigger boys, right? I wanted to play larger, and I never got that slot car. That's it.
My heart. That was LeVar Burton for Million Bazillion from Marketplace, a new podcast answering tricky money questions for kids and their families. A new episode is out today. Find it wherever you download. This final note on the way out, maybe you've heard about this thing where people in America are getting mysterious seeds in the mail, which appear to be coming from China. Yeah, that's happening. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has been investigating. It says the seed packages don't seem to be carrying pests or diseases. They have identified some invasive weed species, but also roses, cabbage, mustard. Nevertheless, they say it is weird and not cool, and they would like the U.S. Post Office to please stop delivering the seeds. As if the Post Office doesn't have enough going on. And here is your moment of economic context before we go. One of the few bright spots for consumers in this pandemic has been super low interest rates. Great time to refinance or buy a house or a new car. But the New York Times reports today that banks are tightening lending standards for mortgages and even credit cards. Of course they are. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.